teeth here who are DJs, and it's just, it's a special place.
It's a creative place. It's very creative. There's a lot of artists here. It's political, and I like the politics. There's great people here.
Come on down to the next volunteer orientation on Wednesday, January 8th from 7 to 9 p.m. here at the KVU Studios at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue.
Coming in from London, from over the pole, flying in a big airliner, chicken flying everywhere around the plane. Could we ever feel much finer? Coming into Los Angeles, bringing in a couple of keys. Don't touch my bags if you please, Mr. Customs Man. Get to Mexico. No, he couldn't look much stranger. Walking in a hall with his things and all. Smiling, said it was a Lone Ranger. Coming into Los Angeles. Bringing in a couple of keys. Don't touch my bags if you please, Mr. Customs Man.
Yes, yes, it's nostalgia. It's nostalgia, folks. Amazingly enough, though, we still have draconian laws against drugs. And amazingly enough, we have huge numbers of people that the prison industrial complex keeps locked up for profit for them and misery for those who are locked up. We're going to talk today about a little bit of this. But first, I have to tell you, this is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial in Portland, the Abe and Joe talk radio show. Abe Proctor, who is popping in, just walked in the door, and me, Joe Uris. Number to call, 231-8187. I want to do a little announcement, and then we'll get into the drug thing. This is important, and I'm stepping out of the usual role. I have to ask you out there, to please call your congressman, call Earl Blumenauer, call all of the congressional people you know. Earl Blumenauer's number is in Portland is 503-231-2300. For Susan Bonamici, it's 503-469-8010. And here's the message. Don't fast track the Pacific Partnership, the Pacific Trade Partnership, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, This is the trade pact that will screw over American jobs, that will mess up the whole relationship among the many, many, many workers in America, that will essentially take away from the American people the right to control their own economy. This isn't an exaggeration.
Wait, we have the right to control our own economy?
Well, no. Okay. It'll just make it worse. And, in fact, this is something that you can influence. You got to be really clear. You got to be really defining the problem, and you got to be really loud about this. They're trying to fast-track it. That means there'll be no debate, no discussion, push it through Congress, probably supported by the Republicans. They might not, because they won't support anything Obama does, but I think they will, and this is a...
Well, they will. It's supported by the ownership class, and both parties are in the ownership class's pockets, so therefore...
You think?
It will have bipartisan support.
Okay, that is my big commercial announcement of the day. A commercial announcement. No, really. But what we want to talk about today, what we want to focus in on, I think it's important, is the whole drug war, the whole drug culture, the whole phenomenon of the changing values in America regarding marijuana and its implications for drugs that are a little more serious in their cultural impact and perhaps even in their physical impact.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they legalized it in Washington State and Colorado and in Uruguay.
Uruguay?
Yeah.
Really?
In Uruguay.
Uruguay,
yeah.
Which I used to have the Tempomeros, you know, radical leftist.
Indeed, yeah.
Well. That's irrelevant.
Yeah, now they produce good soccer players and weed.
Well, yeah. You know, I mean, do the soccer players play?
I don't know.
While they're stoned, but, I mean, what's going on out there in Uruguay?
I really don't know. In Uruguay, though, their legalization initiative was interesting in that it's not a tourism thing at all. It's really not a money raising thing at all. Although it is going to be regulated and taxed. If you're a foreigner in Uruguay, you can't purchase any legal marijuana.
No dope. If you're a foreigner,
it's for natives only.
Oh,
yeah. But that's not the case in Colorado, where apparently...
they've run out of it.
Apparently prices have skyrocketed.
Prices have skyrocketed. Good week. Weed is no longer... they've run out of weed already.
They have. I know.
They ran out of weed yesterday.
And that's a not insignificant point, because I have a sneaking feeling that other jurisdictions are going to be looking at Colorado and Washington with envy when they realize how much money they're leaving on the table by continuing to criminalize this relatively harmless plant.
Well, but of course the prison industrial complex will be unhappy.
Prison industrial complex will be unhappy, and I think it's a subject for another show entirely. Why that privatized prisons are such a bad idea?
Really, and we're not going to spend any time on that today. But I do want to talk about this whole drug thing, and this, I want to have some actual caveats about legalization. And I want to talk a little bit about more serious drugs.
Okay, well, why don't we start with what is the rationale behind legalization in Colorado?
All right, I'll play. What is the rationalization?
I'm asking you to tell us.
Well, all right, look. The fact of the matter is that marijuana has a couple of things that we need to understand. When the U.S. effectively cracked down, well, not effectively, that's wrong to put. When the U.S. put enormous pressure on Mexico and enormous pressure on marijuana growers in this country, the result was that the marijuana industry got scientific, and they began to breed much more effective weed. Nowadays, if you can afford it and if you can find it, you can get marijuana with a tetrahydrocannabinol content, that's THC, as high as, get ready for this, 30%. Now, that's expensive. That's expensive, boo, but it's available out there. And there is no longer a lot of that. When I was a young man, really a young man, you would buy a key, that's a kilogram, of marijuana packed together, usually made heavier by the addition of Pepsi or Coca-Cola. I mean, really nasty stuff. And you could buy that for a relatively cheap price. A lid, which was a short ounce of marijuana in New York or San Francisco or Portland, Oregon, cost anywhere from $10 to $20. And it was ghastly.
Yet you bought it.
I never bought it, but I smoked it. I will confess to that. It was terrible. And, you know, my first, shall I reminisce a little nostalgia here?
Well, I suppose.
I can do that. When I was a kid in San Diego, going to San Diego High, we were right on the border there, so there were a lot of drugs. The main drugs there were pills, uppers and downers, and then the other drug that was readily available in the crowd I ran in, or not actually the crowd I ran in, but the crowd I ran toward, smoked marijuana, which was very available, and it varied in quality, but mostly wasn't very strong. And it came from Mexico. And it was kind of quasi-hip thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And there were no stoners, as we now understand the term, because it was a special, you know, special insider thing.
There were beatniks.
There were beatniks, yes. There were beatniks. There were beatniks, man. And it was, it was a thing. And it kind of indicated a certain insider status. Some of the social crowd smoked marijuana. Mostly, though, it was Mexican Americans, of which my high school was one third, and African Americans the other third, and then the final third was white people. And of the white people, there were those who were interested in jazz, who were interested by my senior year, very much interested in folk music. And they were the candidates for interest in all of this. And all of us associated this with a rebellious attitude and a counter, what it later became known as a countercultural attitude.
Mm-hmm.
So it did carry with it social stigma and social signifiers.
Sure.
And it was cool.
Right.
And I would in those days read articles by experts who said, oh, it doesn't really do much and it's just a social phenomenon. Well, First of all, I don't know where those people or what they were smoking. I guess mostly tobacco. But the fact of the matter is that by 1961 in New York City, there was very strong marijuana available at significant prices, which meant that...
Significantly expensive or not so expensive?
Well, I ran with people who didn't charge me, so I don't know.
Got it.
Yeah. Anyway, the thing was that I can remember one time being in a room with a couple of people from the Living Theater in on Lower East Side on East First, at First Avenue, First at First, and one guy's taking me aside after a bunch of people had left the room and said, come here. And this guy, we smoked this joint that turned the whole world into a glassine phenomenon. Everything reflected light in a different way. It seemed that it was a marvelous experience. Then, of course, because we were...
I'm sure it's going to wear off any time now.
Yeah, then, of course, we decided the thing to do was to go down to Times Square and watch horror movies. You know, I mean, it was real classy stuff, right?
All right.
Okay. But there were jazz musicians, there were folk musicians, there was a scene.
And how are we going to get from here to the reason these jurisdictions legalized marijuana?
Well, what happened over time, as I suggested, was first of all, the government decided to crack down on this terrible phenomenon because that particularly the FBI and the Drug Enforcement, later the Drug Enforcement Administration, and originally the Bureau of Narcotics, all believed that there was an association, a cultural association, between the people who did drugs, whatever drugs, and the people who had politics that were left and critical of the government.
I see.
And as time passed, the government's effort to crack down on, particularly on marijuana, led to the development, as I say, of new strains of marijuana, which actually did have more potency.
How did the government's attempt to crack down lead to different and better strains?
Well, it became very difficult. First of all, it became very difficult to move huge amounts of cheap, bad dope into the United States, and it became more logical and profitable to have a stronger strain in a smaller amount for a greater cash turnover.
Also, just the simple law of supply and demand.
Right.
If people want it, then someone will provide it to them.
Well,
it doesn't matter what the government does.
Yeah, the fact of the matter was that... By the time, say, 1962 or 63, there was a marijuana subculture. It was everywhere. It burst into Reed College. It burst into every place, Portland State, University of Oregon, all over in Oregon and everywhere in the country among college students, mm-hmm. not the old working class or the jazz set.
Particularly on the coasts.
Well, towns
around.
There's no real survey research that's reliable, but sure, on the East and West Coast, also on the Gulf Coast. And as a consequence of that and of a consequence of Better Boo, is that the name of our station? Anyway, the Better Boo, the result was that people began to smoke more and more marijuana. It became an in thing to do among huge numbers of people. So what was in became a large countercultural phenomenon. It was associated with certain kinds of music, with certain kinds of sexual behavior, with certain kinds of political behavior. And all of that came together in what is labeled by certain sociologists and historians the counterculture.
During the 1960s and 70s.
Well, during the 60s. In the 60s, in the early 60s, the political concerns were to prevent nuclear testing, to prevent nuclear war. By the time Vietnam was a big issue, the culture had solidified into one that a kind of cultural test, I believe, was whether or not one was aware of and perhaps occasionally used or frequently used marijuana.
So I'm curious here. Is there something intrinsic about marijuana and the experience that gravitates one towards a leftist countercultural mindset? Or is it simply a marker, a badge? If you are of that sort of bent, this is something you might do because other people of that bent also do it. What I'm saying is, did the government actually believe that smoking pot turned you into a radical commie?
The answer to all of that is yes.
Okay.
All of that.
Okay.
Okay. Now, I don't remember, there were guys like Becker, a sociologist, who argued that marijuana was a group phenomenon. You didn't really get that high. He was a jazz musician as well as a sociologist. But if that was ever true, and I don't think it ever was, it was not possible. It was not possible to be believed if you had the experience. Writers would write articles. I mean, it was articles in Red Dirt. There was an article called Red Dirt Marijuana talking about Texas weed. Mm-hmm. There were there was Evergreen Magazine. There was a whole beat slash soon to be called countercultural community, which extolled the virtues of it. I can remember a poster of Allen Ginsberg way back, 61, 2, 3, right in there, with carrying a big sign saying legalize pot. And in fact, when marijuana burst on the scene in places like Reed College and the University of Oregon and Portland State and so on, it came on with an enormous force. And the weed that was available was not of bad quality. Now, at the same time, the government was arguing and began to argue then and continued to argue that better weed was available. Therefore, it was more addictive. Therefore, it was more dangerous. Therefore, it was not the stuff that your grandpa smoked, whoever your grandpa might be or grandma. That is dubious. What I do think is that in more modern times, good botany produced did in fact produce much more powerful marijuana. The amount of the content of THC and other cannabinoids increased. There was at that time virtually no medical research on marijuana. That is, did it have a medical use? It was not being paid attention to. The assumptions were in the great majority of society that this was a dissipator. And there was
What does that mean? A dissipator.
A dissipator. It dissipated people's interest in doing the things that society wanted people to do. There was
keep your head down, work hard, make your boss rich, marry someone, settle down, and don't rock the boat.
Exactly. And there was something called amotivational syndrome. Hmm. That was, get up, smoke a little doobie here, and hang out, and maybe I'll watch some TV, listen to music, and... wow. That was the stereotype.
Right.
Was it true? I think there were people who really did abuse marijuana. I also think there were a lot more people that used marijuana. All the musicians I knew, including classical musicians, by the way, found it a useful drug in their creative work.
Okay. There's a couple things I want to do here.
Yeah,
I want to get to the origins of the drug war as we understand it. I want to get to the callers that are standing by, and I also want to
all the stoners are wanting to call us, right?
Right. I want to clarify something you just talked about, and that is the belief or the association of marijuana use and addiction. Now we can say unequivocally on this radio program that marijuana is not a physically addictive drug.
No, but it is habit forming.
Right. If you are a daily user, even a heavy daily user, and you stop, you are not going to get delirium tremens. You are not going to get the sweats, the shakes.
The things you get with alcohol.
Right. Or withdrawal from harder drugs.
Yeah.
That is not going to happen. But what you said is also true. It can be habit forming, and it can be hard to shake that habit.
Right.
But addiction, as it is medically understood, marijuana is not an addictive drug.
No, and that was known early on.
Right.
So
right, but the myth that it was addictive, I think, persisted, particularly among the prohibitionists in the government and on the right wing of the political spectrum.
Right. Well, remember that when a guy named Harry Anslinger was head of the Narcotics Bureau of the federal government, it was in his interest and the interest of his bureau to create an enormous fear. The first time I ever even understood marijuana beyond a vague reference in some novels and stuff was actually in a class that was required in California high schools called Basic Citizenship. Mm-hmm. And that involved two narcotics cops from the local San Diego Police Department who came in and had a display case full of all the drugs they had grabbed. So there was heroin. There was methamphetamine didn't even exist as far as I knew then. It did exist, but it wasn't a big deal. But there was uppers and downers, black beauties and blah, 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 all these pills. And there was marijuana. And the guy said, the danger is if you try this stuff, you may become addicted for life just one time.
It's a gateway drug.
Gateway,
right.
Yes, and very dangerous.
Indeed.
And oh my goodness, oh my golly. And they attempted to scare us away from all this. Meanwhile, in my high school, you could buy the stuff. And it was not very, it was, most of it was, I think, not very potent.
Well, clearly it is a gateway to things like multiple Olympic gold medals and the presidency of the United States.
Apparently. Yeah, but yes. Then it turns out the presidency, the guy who smokes the marijuana and is the president, is not, betrays the left and the progressives. So maybe it's marijuana that's at fault there.
Maybe see. So. Well, let's take a few phone calls.
Yeah.
All right. Sheila, good morning.
Hi, Sheila.
Hi, you're on the air.
Maybe not.
All right, who's next? Let's go to Joe. Good morning.
Hey, guys.
Hey.
I'm really glad that you are, you know, bringing this subject back to the airwaves. And I wanted to interject a talking point that I don't think comes up enough when either you guys or really anyone in the media is talking about marijuana legalization. And it has to do with class in a lot of ways. And
yes.
That has to do with the assumption of who gets to produce and on what terms does this drug, any other drug, but really marijuana. And I'm thinking of how with OCTA, the Oregon Cannabis Tax Act, which barely was defeated, the, you know, one of the kind of interesting key clauses or whatever of that bill was that it was not going to restrict personal production or use, which would either be, you know, your own consumption or if you wanted to gift it. And this is something that comes up a lot when I, you know, talk to people who either just do the drug or are close to people who produce and distribute it, is that, you know, legalization is happening in the framework of the capitalist economy. It's happening in the framework of capitalist licensure, which, you know, tends to favor large organizations. And I just, you know, I think we need to talk about that a bit more, that it's not just a matter of, you know, legalizing the drug and it'll be, but, you know, also asking, you know, what are we legalizing it into?
Well, I think you're raising an interesting point. And remember, we live in a capitalist kind of economy, and profitability is a very key factor. And certainly making marijuana, that is producing marijuana, and then being able to sell it with an enormous markup, as is the case today, is an extremely tempting way to earn a living. And particularly if you have a propensity for or interest in botany and chemistry, being able to develop your own strains is very exciting. It's exciting work, and people.
Yeah, it's like craft brewing.
Well,
yeah, and it grows like a weed.
Yeah, it grows like a weed. I don't think it's equivalent to cocaine. By the way, I think cocaine cannot. I don't
no,
think
craft you, brewing is what I said.
Oh, I see. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Craft brewing.
Craft brewing.
Not crack cocaine.
Sorry, bad hearing here. Okay, never mind. Anyway, no, I think that one of the biggest problems now will be how can those who want to make money on marijuana, particularly large corporations, how will they manage this? How will they get control of it? And I'm sure they're thinking about it all the time. I remember mythology. I'm pretty sure it was mythological back in 68, 69, right in there, where people were talking about how the cigarette companies had already copyrighted names like Acapulco Gold because they saw that eventually it would be legalized and they wanted to find a way to get that money. Now, I don't know, and I don't believe that really was true, but it was a kind of cultural recognition of the potential money-making value of marijuana as a large-scale commercial product.
Well, listen, thank you very much for the call.
Sure.
Appreciate it. I think that's another reason that the Washington and Colorado experiments are going to be watched very, very closely.
Yeah.
The capitalist upside here is enormous.
Well, yeah. But on the other hand, I want to really emphasize this because there is a downside to marijuana.
Sure.
I'm sure that inhaling particles, hot
yep.
particles, mm-hmm. can cause lung damage.
Yeah, smoking things is not a good idea.
Yeah, smoking things.
Yeah.
Now, eating things?
Sure.
Not so bad.
Right. Well, but I don't want to go down a detour here about the various ways in which you can take in marijuana.
No, I'm not interested in that at all.
What I would like
Besides
to get...
Besides which, we have to say, no. Okay,
right.
Go ahead.
What I would like to get to here in just a moment is the origins of the drug war. The backlash throughout the 70s and 80s and 90s and, mm-hmm. and the aughts. Mm-hmm. And I also want to get into the, as the caller alluded, the class and racial aspects of decriminalization of marijuana.
Well, and I think that latter thing is very important, particularly when you move away from marijuana discussion to the cocaine discussion,
yeah.
where, in fact, we actually passed racist laws in the United States making a distinction between crack cocaine and powder cocaine.
Right.
And even now, that's barely being addressed and barely being made. The people who went to jail, huge sentences for right. the crack and lesser sentences for the powder.
Right, along racial lines. More yeah. white people tended to use powder cocaine.
Right.
It was recognized as a drug of affluence, whereas crack was used mostly by African Americans and was recognized as a drug of the not affluent. All right, well, how does this apply to marijuana? Well, basically, we'll take African Americans and white people. African Americans and European Americans use marijuana at about the same rate, statistically.
Yes.
African Americans are arrested for, cited for, and imprisoned for marijuana use and possession at a much higher rate than are white Americans.
Yes.
So there is a racial component to the prohibition of marijuana.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And that's a cultural disparity, which, by the way, is consistent for all kinds of crimes, particularly crimes without victims, in the communities involved.
Indeed. All right, let's take another phone call. Greg, good morning. Nope, Sheila.
Sheila, hi.
Good morning. Well, you started out discussing the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I had a couple of comments on that. First of all, Obama is pushing for fast track. And you alluded to the fact, I think.
Hey, Sheila. Sheila, we're not. That's not the topic of today's conversation.
But Sheila,
you started off talking about the.
Well, I mentioned it because it's important, and I mentioned it because I want people to call their congressman about it. But that's not the topic today.
Okay, well, too bad, because I have a couple of very good points to make on that. But maybe another day.
Yes, we certainly will revisit
it. In fact,
it.
Maybe next week.
All okay. right. Who's next, Steve? Greg, good morning.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey, I've been waiting for this show for a little while now.
Well, good.
Whoa, man, you've got nothing else to do. What are you saying?
The coverage of the legalization, so-called legalization in Colorado and Washington is been abysmal, and the coverage on cable has been just the same, you know. I just want to start by correcting language. Dope, cannabis is not dope. Generally, dope was associated with opiate use, because it actually makes you nod off, and it's a very destructive way to describe what's a natural plant, which is very beneficial to all humans, and other mammals, by the way. I don't even use the word cannabis because it's just a slang word that Anslinger picked out amongst many Mexican words, the most common being mota, they use for cannabis.
Mm-hmm.
Cannabis is a plant. It's not a drug. So when you talk about cannabis being stronger, as an example, it doesn't mean you're going to be hooked earlier or be more addicted, which is a huge part. That word and the 12-step dogma is a huge part of the drug war. That's when you want to talk about the origins of it. You when you talk about a natural substance, it something that's stronger doesn't mean that it's more dangerous. And in fact, cannabis is completely non-toxic. Now, the reason that it's non-toxic is we have a system within our body that's called the endocannabinoid system.
Mm-hmm.
So we have at least 6 or 8 natural cannabinoids. Now, because the feds have decided that cannabis is so dangerous, and one of the reasons it is dangerous, Joe, is because it makes people reflect in their thoughts, and they have a harder time, you know, swallowing stuff that happens on Fox News. So it is dangerous politically. Let's see, lost my track there.
Uh-oh.
Which is, you know, does happen when you're a responsible user of cannabis like I've been my entire life.
See, it is dangerous.
Yeah.
Well, and that's probably a good behavior, though, and it also, of course, is a natural stress reliever.
Yes.
So the endocannabinoid system is the reason why we have medical benefits of all sorts, and it's also the reason why you can prove that it's non-toxic. Because there are no endocannabinoid receptors in the base of the brain that would affect breathing, which is what makes a drug toxic. So cannabis is not a drug by all sorts of definitions, but the drug war, of course, has associated it with, you know, what I call the powder drugs, which are technically drugs that people take to forget, including alcohol. Now, natural drugs, which include cannabis and all the other psychedelics, I do believe that cannabis is a mild psychedelic, which is a good thing. These are drugs that allow you to remember, and you don't need to forget things, not because life is bad.
Well, wait a minute. Now, come on, man. You know that people who get stoned forget stuff.
Well, I don't think that's what he's getting at.
This is a good thing, Joe. Short-term memory loss is good because it relieves stress in life. No. And for me, for example, having to listen to very bad coverage on the drug war relieves that stress. Now, I do believe that cannabis actually improves long-term memory. So, as an example, cannabis has many protective qualities medically. One thing it does is protect the lungs. So I'm also a tobacco user, and I believe that cannabis is helping. Is going to help me, hopefully, not have lung cancer.
Wait. Now, what basis? I mean, that seems like a kind of a far-out argument.
Many protective qualities. So the big pharma, because the feds have decided to put cannabis on Schedule 1, what that means is we can't do research on plant matter. And they've done a lot of research outside of the country, which is there's literally thousands of studies talking about the cannabinoid qualities of the cannabis plant. Mm-hmm. Here in this country, though, Big Pharma has been allowed to run wild over it. So we have dozens, probably more than 100, drugs that are in the pipeline and being used right now that are developed in the endocannabinoid system. Do you know the things that are showing up at the head shops, the spice and the other names? These are all refugees from endocannabinoid research. They're psychoactive synthetic cannabinoid molecules that happen to be psychoactive. And they're dangerous because they do not have the buffering qualities that the cannabis plant will have when you use it.
So we need you to wrap this up.
Well, I'm just getting started.
Yeah, I know, yeah. I know. But we can't let you go the rest of the show.
If you want to talk about the legalization things that you're talking about in Colorado, Washington, not true legalization because they still have felonies involved. What we had here in Oregon, which the person that got it on the ballot has been stealing money from people for 30 years, so nobody would give him any money. And we had no possession limits, no plant limits. Anybody could grow. Now, the feds would have been challenging this stuff, believe me. What they have in Colorado and Washington is some sort of extreme decriminalization where anything under an ounce is nothing. Anything over an ounce is a felony. So people are still going to jail. It's not legalization. Now, the people that are pushing these initiatives are believing, like you guys do, use the language of the cops and the language of the drug war. The drug, it's a drug, it's dangerous, and it's more addictive because it's stronger. So these guys have decided, for some reason, to have these weird DUI laws, which are bizarre, because cannabis does not impair you in the driving, because it doesn't impair your hand-eye coordination. So you're going to have people getting DUI things now when the laws didn't exist before, and apparently the people that are pushing these initiatives believe that this is a price to pay.
But wait, now I have to stop you here. Look, I am not in favor of criminalization of marijuana, but I cannot argue that it doesn't alter consciousness, which means to me that I don't want somebody walking around with a 45 automatic who's stoned.
Well, hey, listen, thank you very much for the call.
Right.
Okay, I don't think he was contending that the marijuana doesn't alter consciousness. He was saying it doesn't impair hand-eye coordination. I'm not prepared on the radio to endorse that stance, nor am I prepared to endorse his claim that smoking marijuana protects the lungs. I'm not on board with those two claims.
You're not buying that.
Right. I don't think it's a good idea to get high and drive your car. I don't.
No.
All right. 503-231-8187.
What about getting high and doing something else?
Most things where you don't put somebody else's life in danger, I think that's just fine.
If you want to
get high and stay home and listen to music or raid your fridge or have sex or whatever, that's fine. Go to the movies, whatever.
You don't see it as a judgment alterer?
A judgment alterer?
Alterer.
Well, I think anytime you ingest or imbibe or whatever, inhale a substance that alters your consciousness, yes, I think that you have to... thereby infer that, yes, any judgment you make in that state is going to be affected by that state. Whether it's negative, I don't know. But I would say, though, that probably, generally speaking, you're going to make better decisions when you use marijuana than you are when you're roaring drunk.
I would agree with that. But I do think that in our culture, the use of any substance, and alcohol is the most popular by far, that any use of any substance in the context of social behavior is going to have a degree of negative consequence for a large part of the population. I mean, I just have to say
certainly,
that.
Certainly. Yeah. But that brings us to another aspect of the legalization debate, which is harm mitigation. And I want to get there in a little while.
Okay.
All right. Let's go back, pick up our historical thread that we had going earlier, right?
Oh, yes.
Where did we leave off? We left off in the 60s with the counterculture.
I don't remember because I was all stoned.
Right. And your short-term memory is right.
It's all shot.
So we left off in the 60s with the growth of the counterculture movement and the calcification of the belief on the right that the use of these substances, principally marijuana, mm-hmm. Turned one into a raving commie hippie pinko anti-establishment.
Well, I think it was less. Actually, I don't think the argument was focused on politics, left, right, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I think it was more focused on responsibility versus irresponsibility. And the suggestion, the link there was that leftism was inherently irresponsible.
Right. And thus, using marijuana
would
inherently
leave you
irresponsible.
Be irresponsible. And if you were irresponsible, right. You might become a leftist.
Right. So, needless to say, there was a fairly significant official backlash to the countercultural movement in the 1960s.
Yeah.
So in 1971, I'm quoting now from an article in this week's New Yorker. There's a couple of really great articles about this issue. In 1971, in a message to Congress, President Richard Nixon called drug abuse, quote, a national emergency, unquote. We have faced great difficulties again and again, he said. Wars and depressions and divisions among our people. If Congress furnished, quote, the authority and the funds to match our moral resources, there it is, a moral question, the use of drugs. Okay. The question was not whether we will conquer drug abuse, but how soon. And thus was the war on drugs born. The Drug Enforcement Administration was created under Nixon mm-hmm. With an initial budget of $75 million. And since then, that number has only grown over the ensuing 4+ decades.
But look at the success it's had. More cocaine use than ever before.
Yep. More cocaine available, cheaper cocaine available, better quality cocaine available. The same is true with heroin. The same is true with marijuana. By almost every objective measure, the war on drugs has been an abject failure that has done nothing but cost us millions upon billions of dollars, incarcerated a whole bunch of people who are no threat to society, increased the racial disparity in prison sentencing almost across the board, and really accomplished nothing at all for all of its moral posturing, for all of the money spent, for all of the lives lost, for all of the military force projected across the world.
We said earlier, actually created a market for higher quality marijuana.
Yeah, yeah. And the legislation that grew from this initial launch of the war on drugs, it is now common practice, for example, for the United States military to be brought in to assist with drug interdiction efforts, particularly in countries where we currently have military operations going on. There's a wonderful story in The New Yorker about that distinction, talking about how special forces units helped wipe out opium or poppy fields in Afghanistan during the ongoing Afghanistani conflict.
The endless Afghan.
Yes. But we're not able to help out in an interdiction in Honduras because we have no state of war existing in Honduras. So it created this vast legal arena in which the military is sometimes permitted under the cloak of law to come in and bust up drug trafficking operations.
Well, and this brings up the foolishness of the interdiction efforts by the United States, including the use of paraquat and other herbal poisons that were sprayed almost indiscriminately all over fields in Mexico, fields where either poppy or cocaine were grown. The result was that the growers simply cut down forests in these locations and grew the product in those forests because there is no other industrial base. There is no other opportunity. This possibility of a cash crop that yields an enormous return on the investment of labor and effort and money, in the end, it can't be stopped by that process. In fact, there's some evidence that when you make it more difficult to obtain, you inevitably raise the price and value of the product.
Indeed, you do. What's ironic about this whole discussion is that basic economics, the most basic economics, the kind you learn in high school, could tell you that the drug war would be a failure.
Mm-hmm.
The invisible hand provides, right? If there is a demand for these substances, then somebody will provide it. And the harsher the countermeasures, the more aggressive the interdiction efforts, the more profitable supplying those substances becomes.
And as our engineer Steve points out in a little note he handed me, there's a whole banking industry now built basically offshore to stash the money of large growers and of large dealers in all of these illicit substances.
So the idea behind decriminalization then becomes pretty simple, and marijuana is a good way to frame this whole argument. Consider your typical marijuana user. Is he or she beyond the fact that possession and use of marijuana is itself a crime in most places?
Yeah.
The average marijuana user, is he or she a criminal? And the answer is no. By and large, these are ordinary people who are not a menace to themselves or to anybody else. They are not committing violent acts under the influence of this drug. They are not undertaking a criminal lifestyle to support their use of the drug. They are simply people who enjoy using marijuana. They are not a threat. Criminals.
But no, see, the definition of criminal is a socially constructed reality.
It is.
So
indeed.
If you do these things, you are by definition a criminal.
By definition,
you've
a criminal.
You've been labeled.
Yes. So if you use this illegal substance, you are by definition a criminal. But are you doing anyone any harm? No, you are not. And further, is the prohibition of this substance doing society a harm? And I think the answer to that is unequivocally yes. You look at how many people occupy jail cells in this country who are there because of the possession of or use of marijuana. They are nonviolent offenders. They are hurting no one. They are doing nothing but costing taxpayers money and taking up space in our already overcrowded prison system. This is laughable. This is nonsensical. And the prohibition of marijuana does more societal and economic harm than it does good, which is why legalization is a good idea.
Well, in fact, we have the model of prohibition of alcohol in the 1920s. And we saw the consequence of that.
Engineer Steve just whispered in our ear, how are we going to lock up black people without drug laws? And the answer is, hey, maybe we won't lock up black people.
Well, at least no more than we lock up other people for right. The crimes that there are. No, I think that I'm, first of all, I think that there is, in any mind-altering substance, whether it's alcohol or cocaine or marijuana or whatever, per se, an inherent danger of abuse.
Yes.
It's just the case. There are lots and lots of alcoholics. The solution we've discovered to the problem of alcoholism in our society was not to outlaw alcohol. That produced the mafia. That produced an enormous industry in the creation of alcohol and so on. And that produced actually a statistically measurable increase in alcohol use among young people in the 1920s. So if that was true then, what about marijuana? Well, we're seeing a very similar pattern there. And again, if you're going to be rational and logical, the problem needs to be addressed through education, through job opportunities, through a whole host of services that give meaning to life outside of the use of substances.
Right.
So I don't want to fall into the pattern of saying, oh, marijuana is good. Marijuana may turn out to be, if we're allowed to do the research, very valuable. We already see some evidence, very clear evidence, that marijuana is very useful for people with a whole host of disorders, including neurological disorders.
Yeah.
And it also reduces pain. And it also reduces, interestingly enough, in people who have cancers, some kinds of cancers, a lower need for narcotics to intervene in their discomfort.
Indeed.
So we know there's a potential enormous value there, just as there is in narcotics, by the way.
Right.
And we know that there is a potential for abuse. The question then becomes really, well, how do you deal with the abuse question? And I think it's a social problem that cannot be addressed by simply making a law against it and putting people in jail.
Right. For a fraction of the cost and a fraction of the effort, you can offer programs that mitigate the harm done by widespread use of marijuana.
Now here's an irony. We had a caller, a woman, who was very annoyed that we were not going to talk about TPP today, which I introduced because I wanted people to call their congresspeople, and I do want you to call your congresspeople and complain about a fast-tracking of that disastrous proposal, which is not unlike the North American Free Trade Agreement, which, if you remember, led to enormous struggle in Seattle. But she was annoyed because here we are talking about something that's, so what? And yet there's this other thing that is so pressing and so important. In reality, existentially, the very fact that we spend time talking about this rather than talking about these other very real things that are going mm-hmm. on, I'm not saying this isn't real, but very real things, is an evidence of how this whole drug war nonsense has distorted the conversation. Do you follow me?
Oh, absolutely.
And, yeah. You know, I don't mind doing a show on it. That's today. But to fall into the pattern of spending a lot of time on it, that's kind of wasteful.
I agree. Who do we have? Michael, good morning.
Good morning, guys.
Hey, what's up?
Well, first of all, a story from the 50s about marijuana being illegal. Mm-hmm. There was a story that went around Brooklyn that was possibly apocryphal, that some narcs had come to a classroom somewhere in the city, and they were telling everybody about how evil drugs were, and they passed two joints out into the class so that everybody could see what it was they weren't supposed to do.
Uh-oh.
And they did this big speech about how, and you better not put this in your pocket because we'll find it and take you away and put you in jail and everything. So they passed out two joints and they got back three.
That's a nice apocryphal story.
Yeah, and you know, I don't know if it's true or not, but the story went around. Everybody.
It's good. Well, let me ask you. My understanding of your work, though you remain anonymous to us, is that you really are into computers and that world. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay, absolutely. Now, have you, in your experience and the experience of your colleagues, noted a disadvantage to the use or an advantage or a neutrality in the use of marijuana?
Well, I wasn't going to talk about this, but since you mentioned this, there's a book called What the Dormouse Said, you know, line from the Jefferson Airplane song.
Right.
This is a book about how a group of very bright, high-tech people got together in the early 60s and started doing LSD.
Ah, LSD.
Expanding their minds.
Mm-hmm.
But they were focused on what can we do with computers. And out of this group came the people that went to Xerox PARC and invented GUIs and all of the Ethernet and laser printers. That whole movement that, you know, eventually became like the Macintosh and then Windows,
mm-hmm.
that started with LSD in the early 60s.
Ah.
Hmm.
These people expanded their minds and used that expansion to think about computers
mm-hmm.
and their application and how to use them. And it was what they were thinking of was augmentation, which means they wanted to augment human capabilities by the application of things you could do with computers.
That's interesting. You don't know if it's a factually based book.
I do know the book. You can book and read it. And I worked with some of these people. I eventually got to Xerox. I was working down the street from Xerox PARC at another Xerox facility, mm-hmm. and I met a lot of these people. And you know, you'd walk into Xerox PARC, and it was like this gorgeous corporate headquarters, like with well-dressed secretaries. They still had secretaries then. Well-dressed secretaries and corporate aides. It looked like one of the most gorgeous corporate headquarters you could ever see, but it looked like a group of Hell's Angels had sort of invaded it and taken it over and eaten all the executives, because the people who all the support were there for would be walking around the halls with bare feet and leather pants and no shirt and dreadlocks. I mean, it was just...
That sounds like a very uncomfortable outfit. But I want to just make a point. Now, Michael, you are consistently one of our more rational right-wing callers, I think it's fair to say.
Yes.
And yet, here you are talking essentially in praise of the creative potential of these psychedelic drugs and of marijuana.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So there is an odd confluence, if I may suggest it, between people who are politically quite conservative, but are libertarian also in their orientation, saying, "Hey, this is a stupid set of laws." Is that fair to say?
Oh man, I've been for drug legalization since the first time I could think about it.
Aha! Uh-huh. Well, see how it messed up your mind, man.
No, it expanded my mind.
Michael,
expanded my mind.
Michael, thank you very much for the information. Thanks for the call.
Well, wait. One
wait,
other
wait,
thing.
Wait. Right, okay, right. Quick.
Two other things. One is very quick, and the other one is a question for you guys.
All right.
The very quick thing is they all talk about how, now the marijuana is so strong, it's dangerous. Even if it wasn't dangerous when you were doing it, now it's dangerous.
Right.
Well, you know, you smoke marijuana and you can control, it's very easy to control exactly how high you get. So if you have really strong marijuana, you take one hit of it and you go, that's enough. So, you know, that whole thing is ridiculous. And we had something just as strong as what they have now. Back then it was called hashish.
Oh, right, hash.
You take a half a hit of hash and, you know, you'd forget why you were holding whatever that was in your hand, you know. So You know, that's bogus. And then I have a question for you.
Okay.
Both of you. This is something I don't know, but I have this vague recollection. When crack started becoming a big thing, it became a big emergency, especially in the black community. It was really destructive. And I have this vague recollection that the difference in penalties between crack and powder cocaine started out as something that was initiated politically from like the Congressional Black Caucus or somebody like that. I don't remember if that's true or not, but I have this vague recollection. Do you guys know about that?
I don't.
I don't either. I do know that there was an assumption that crack cocaine was somehow inherently much more dangerous and very different.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'll tell you a quick story. I was with my child, and we went we were in New York on a kind of tourist adventure, high school thing, and we happened to be down at Wall Street. Here I wanted to show her, here's where the money is, and blah blah blah. And it was lunchtime, and all these people came out in their suits and so on, and standing around waiting for them were all these dope dealers. And all the dope dealers seemed to be dealing in various kinds of cocaine, and maybe marijuana. I didn't get close enough to know for sure, but it seemed like it was cocaine. And it was we're talking probably pounds changing hands just in one lunch hour. And both my daughter and I were kind of shocked. It was kind of amazing. I hadn't thought about it in those terms. But now there's a movie out, several movies out, in fact, that talk about that era in terms of that enormous drug abuse that took place. And I do think there's a difference between drug utilization and drug abuse. And I think the measure of abuse is not the quantity involved, but whether or not one functions responsibly and well in life.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Hey, I agree.
Thanks for the call, Michael.
Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate it.
Yeah.
All right, coming up this morning on KBOO at 9, Alternative Radio, Lester Brown speaks on the future of civilization. Apparently, he's going to wrap that up in 1 hour. That's impressive.
Oh, the future of civilization in an hour? I'm all for that.
At 10 on Air
Cascadia. I'm afraid it's true, man.
At 10 on Air Cascadia, Chris Andre hosts a Lynn Stewart Liberation Celebration. At 10:15, Flashpoints features a mini-documentary on the rebuilding of a memorial for slain teen Andy Lopez. And the Iraqi government prepares to invade Fallujah, a city in its own country. Interesting. What's really going on the ground there? At 11 on Stage and Studio, host D.M.A. Roberts features playwright David Henry Huang, Tony Award-winning author of Madame Butterfly, Dance and the Railroad, and Chinglish, which opens on January 11th at Portland Center Stage.
You know, I saw Madame Butterfly. I thought it was great.
Actually, it says here M. Butterfly, which would be what?
Well, Monsieur, no, it is M.
Monsieur
Butterfly.
Monsieur Butterfly, right?
No, it's M. Butterfly. And it was a takeoff on the opera by Puccini.
Right.
And it talks about, you know, about stereotypes and about racism, about colonialism and exploitation of women and a whole bunch of other stuff. And it's really good.
Well, hey. And at 11:30, DMA hosts a special Stage and Studio Extra with POV Dance about an unusual dance and multimedia installation performance in the historic landmark building Left Bank. All this and more coming up today on KBOO.
Yeah, you know, I just want to say this because it's really important. This station is an incredibly valuable resource. People may not realize, particularly younger people listening, that we are the station. That is to say, we are the people that start the stuff and that promote the stuff that makes the change, that makes the society in Portland, Oregon, and elsewhere very much better.
You heard it here first. We start the stuff.
Yeah, that is really coherent I am today.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Barth, good morning.
Don't start no stuff with me.
Yeah, hey, go ahead, man.
Bring us some stuff, Barth. Come on.
Yeah, you got a couple of things that I want to revisit. Joe said that there's no research about marijuana in the country, and all of the research on marijuana in the country has been locked up by the government. It's wider research has been prohibited or channeled to people that will support the government standing. And that includes medical research. In 50-plus years of research that's not controlled by opponents of marijuana has said that it should be legal to possess and to use because it has no noticeable permanent side effects, that it is non-addictive, that it is... less harmful than alcohol is a kind of a universal conclusion, and that the criminalization of it, it has so many negative repercussions for the wider society that it's a really bad idea. And there were prominent politicians, even to the presidential level in this country, who advocated that. And when they got barked at largely by the right and the one percenters, saying, oh, this will make people not want to go to work, they changed their tune and came out saying, oh, this is terrible, this is bad, this must be illegal. And that's well documented. Huge money has gone to bad folks for marketing marijuana, and that's caused all kinds of negative repercussions in many societies.
Well, yeah, and I mean, there's the fictional movie Savages, which deals with the Baja cartel and the movement of large amounts of marijuana as a commercial enterprise, and the fight between the cartels in their attempt to get control of all the marijuana. It's a fictional story, but it's based on some experiences that people really had. There has been an increase, a terrible increase in violence around drugs, period. And that it can happen because they're illegal, and because this is in any case of activity that's illegal, you don't have a judicial way to go to deal with disputes. The only way to deal with it, unfortunately, is violence.
Well, also the fact that, you know, your quote about the invisible hand is at work here, you know, and that people are making, and a lot of that activity started with marijuana, but, you know, gradually and sometimes rapidly evolved into stuff that was more portable.
Right. Well, that's another problem, which we don't have time to talk about, the portability of stronger drugs, more perhaps dangerous drugs. We're running out of time.
Yeah, we have to leave it there.
And we're going to leave it there. I think we probably won't visit this topic for a while because all kinds of terrible other things are happening.
Stay tuned for more about those terrible other things. We'll be back at you next week. Thank you.
It's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
KBOO Community Radio and the North Portland Neighborhood Library is proud to sponsor the Jefferson High School 13th Annual Multicultural Film Festival. On January 14th, the documentary The House I Live In explores the risks that prohibition poses to freedom and the tragedy of addicts being treated as criminals. Meanwhile, the prisons of America are growing overcrowded with nonviolent criminals and illegal drugs are still being sold in schoolyards. This film is being shown on January 14th at the North Portland Neighborhood Library off of Killingsworth Street at 6 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This has been a lifelong dream for me to be on the radio. I've been wanting to be on the radio since I was a kid. I've always been into radio. And that's why I've started volunteering here at KBOO, because I wanted to know everything there was to know about radio.
It's been so much a part of my life for over 30 years plus now, and I can't imagine Portland without it or my life without it. So here we are on KBOO.
It's a cornerstone of Portland. You know, lots of people I know cut their teeth here who are DJs, and it's a special place.
It's a creative place. It's very creative. A lot of artists here. It's political, and I like the politics. There's great people here.
Come on down to the next volunteer orientation on Wednesday, January 8th from 7 to 9 p.m. here at the KBOO Studios at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First on alternative radio, Lester Brown speaks on the future of civilization. At 10 on Air Cascadia, Chris Andre hosts a Lynn Stewart Liberation Celebration. At 10:15, Flashpoints features a mini-documentary on the rebuilding of a memorial for slain teen Andy Lopez. And the Iraq government prepares to invade Fallujah. What's really going on the ground there? At 11 on stage and studio, host Dima Roberts features playwright David Henry Wong, Tony Award-winning author of M. Butterfly, Dance and the Railroad, and Chinglish, which opens on January 11th at Portland Center Stage. And at 11:30, Dima hosts a special stage and studio extra with POV Dance about an unusual dance and multimedia installation performance in the historic landmark building Left Bank. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support for community radio. Now here's Alternative Radio.
I don't think any generation has faced the kinds of issues that we are facing in the world today. What we're talking about is basically the future of civilization. We use the term, you know, saving the planet. The planet's going to be around for a long time. The question is whether we can save civilization. And given the trends we've set in motion with overplowing and overpumping and with excessive carbon emissions and climate change and so forth, we're in trouble as a civilization.
That's Lester Brown, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Lester Brown, The Future of Civilization. When it comes to climate change, the operative word is hot, with record and unprecedented closely following. UN conferences on climate do little beyond the powerful issuing grandiose proclamations about how green they are, and then it's back to their destructive policies. The Guardian newspaper captures the hypocrisy. Governments turn their backs on the living planet, demonstrating that no chronic problem, however grave, will take priority. Rome is burning. The eco-crisis includes rising temperatures and sea levels, deforestation and species extinction, drought and soil erosion, and water and food shortages. In the not-so-distant future, the ecological crimes against the Earth will come home to roost. Rex Weiler in EcoWatch warns, "A great reckoning awaits humanity if we fail to awaken from our delusions. Earth's delicately balanced systems can reach tipping points and collapse." To talk about these issues is Lester Brown. He's